Hello and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is animator turned writer-director Frank Tashlin. Born in New Jersey in 1913, Tashlin began working professionally in animation while still in his teens. He soon landed at Warner Brothers in 1933, working for the legendary Leon Schlesinger. Peripatetic by nature, Tashlin soon left to work for Hal Roach as well as Ub Iwerks, landing back at Warner Brothers just a few years later, where he began to direct cartoons as well as draw them. Tashlin brought an understanding about the film industry and filmmaking to his cartoons, giving them a distinctive and irreverent style. Still unhappy, though, he moved on to Disney, then Columbia, where he ran their animation division. Eventually going back to Warner Brothers yet again, he worked on the Private Snafu cartoons, which were made exclusively for servicemen during World War II. In 1946, he parlayed his animation credits into gag writing for Lucille Ball, the Marx Brothers, and Bob Hope. He was working on Hope's 1951 comedy, The Lemon Drop Kid, when producers fired director Sidney Lanfield, asking Tashlin to finish the movie. Tashlin ended up shooting about a third of the film, leading to 1952's The First Time, his first credited live-action directorial effort. Tashlin directed a few more features, including another with Hope, then teamed with Martin and Lewis for 1955's Artists and Models and 1956's Hollywood or Bust, their final film as a team. He found a willing muse in blonde bombshell Jane Mansfield, directing her and maybe his two finest films, 1956's The Girl Can't Help It and 1957's Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter. Tashlin went on to work with Jerry Lewis as a solo act, directing him six times in movies like The Geisha Boy and Who's Minding the Store. He reteamed with his Rock Hunter star Tony Randall for The Alphabet Murders, with Randall playing Hercule Poirot. Tashlin then directed Doris Day in the spy comedy The Glass Bottom Boat, which was a huge hit. They tried again with 1967's Caprice, which was a flop. Tashlin returned to working with Bob Hope for what would be his final film, 1968's The Private Navy of Sergeant O'Farrell, which is described thusly on the film's own DVD release, quote, "It lacked the usual comedy spark of a Hope film," unquote. Here with me to discuss The Private Navy of Sergeant O'Farrell and the career of Frank Tashlin is producer, writer, director, and Trailers from Hell guru, Michael Schlesinger. Hi, Michael.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for being here. I'm really happy to have a chance to speak to you.
Thank you, and let me offer my condolences that this podcast has sunk so low that you're now forced to have me on as a guest.
As I have mentioned on previous episodes, I am just such a mega fan of of Trailers from Hell that I am just thrilled that I get to talk to any of you guys that are on there, because I watch those things incessantly. Sometimes I'll just put them on random and let them play for like an hour straight, even though I've seen a bunch of them a million times. I just find them so thoroughly entertaining. So, and Frank Tashlin is a subject you've covered a couple of his films for Trailers from Hell. I know you at least did Glass Bottom Boat. And this is someone who I'd always heard of. I had seen one or two of his films before this. I saw Susan Slept Here, and maybe I think I'd seen Glass Bottom Boat at one point. But I figured this was a great chance to learn because I'd heard so much about this guy. I knew he directed the two Jane Mansfield films. So I went on a big deep dive, and I watched about a dozen of his movies. But I do want to ask you to start. Is there something in your mind that is indicative of a Frank Tashlin movie? Is there some element that you feel is he brings to it that you immediately can point to and say, ah, that's Frank Tashlin?
Well, the interesting thing that when he was animating and directing cartoons, his style was to make them look like live action films, you know, with the fast cutting and the bizarre angles and the extreme close up zooms and swish pans and things like that. And then conversely, when he moved into live action, he started putting in all these cartoon gags. So all of a sudden, you're seeing things he did in animation. For example, I think it's Porky's Railroad, where the train is running so slow that the snail is going faster than the train. 27 years later, in The Disorder, he does the exact same gag, except the snail is running faster than Jerry Lewis. So, you know, you never throw away a good gag. That just one example shows, you know, how, I guess for lack of a better term, the flexibility of his humor, that it could adapt to any medium while at the same time sort of erasing the boundary between the two.
It's interesting that none of his films actually feature animation in any way. You know, it's not like the the sequence with Jerry dancing with Gene Kelly in Anchors Away. Like, he doesn't actually have that in any of his films. They're all just strict live action, even though you would think he might have been a natural for that. And when I was doing, again, when I was doing research for this, I was looking up his cartoons, some of the ones that maybe I hadn't seen. I didn't know that he directed Swooner Crooner, the Porky Pig one about the farm that tries to get the chickens to lay eggs and uses all of these sort of quasi-romantic things, including like a rooster that looks like Frank Sinatra. And right. growing up, I must have seen that one 1,000 times. I mean, they played it incessantly. And as a kid, I didn't get the jokes because I didn't know. I knew who Frank Sinatra was, but I didn't know that like in the 40s, he was like known for being so skinny. So like the gag he has where he's behind the microphone and the whole body disappears behind the microphone and you just see the arms and legs, all these amazing visual gags that he thought up and brought to these cartoons. I was like, I've been looking at Frank Tosh and stuff since I was a child. I just didn't know it.
Well, you know, I think this is typical of our generation that when we see something as a kid, we enjoy it on one level. And when we visit it adults, there's this whole additional level of humor that we completely missed because we didn't reference. And my friend Jerry Beck, who has a website called Cartoon Research, some years ago, there was a 3-part article about radio gags in cartoons, especially during the war era, and all those lines of dialogue that we associate with Warner Brothers cartoons, you know, like, I'm only 3.5 years old, and stuff like that. They all came out of radio shows, particularly Red Skelton's. And it's just that we don't hear those radio shows anymore, so we just naturally assume that those jokes originated with the cartoons, when in fact they were merely reflecting, you know, popular entertainment at the time. Well, to go back to the Jane Mansfield pictures, I mean, rock and roll is the catalyst for that movie. The grown-up world, to put it one way, is reacting to this phenomenon that they don't understand. Similarly, in Will's success for Rock Hunter, he's just ripping apart the advertising agency and, to some extent, the gullibility of the American public. And so, you know, again, this fits very much into his worldview of, you know, what's out there that we can mock?
Yeah, well, one of the things I noticed when watching a bunch of his movies, especially you're talking about the Jane Mansfield ones, is that, and I was trying to look for a common theme, I mean, is the irreverence. I mean, and you're talking about like, well, success spoil Rock Hunter. He's mocking advertising and television in 1957, two things that were ascendant in American culture, and here he is mocking it. I mean, there's a scene in Rock Hunter, for anyone who hasn't seen it, where Tony Randall comes out and talks to the audience and says, for those of you used to watching television, you're used to a break right now, so let's take a break. And then you see him as you would see him on television, with in black and white, with the horizontal hold off, and skips, and it's completely savaging television. And
the screen down to the, you know, TV as well. You know, Tom Yule comes out at the beginning as himself, and it's 1:37, black and white, and then he snaps his fingers, and then the screen widens, and he snaps his finger, and it goes to color. And again, this is a direct reference to TV, but you have to remember, in the 1950s, television was considered a direct assault on movie going, and that's one of the reasons you ended up with 3D and CinemaScope and stereo sound and all that other stuff, because they were competing with a medium that they felt, with some justification, was stealing the audience's attention. So this was a way of fighting back in a baby blue kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of amazing to think that movie studios didn't want anybody to mention television because we had to sort of pretend it wasn't happening. And he goes out of his way. I mean, in a bunch of his movies, there are references to the popularity of television in one way or the other. Like in the Glass Bottom Boat, you've got Robert Vaughn cameoing as ostensibly his Man from U.N.C.L.E. character. They don't say that, but that's the gag, is that he's there.
A lot of those. And of course, Man from U.N.C.L.E. was MGM, as was Glass Bottom Boats. So there was no problem in him doing that as long as he agreed to do it.
Right.
And I'm sure he probably on his lunch hour.
Right, yeah. And like in Caprice.
His costume.
Right, yeah, yeah. Like in Caprice, there's a part where Doris Day and Richard Harris are running through this apartment building, and they run through, they just jump in a window, and there's a bunch of kids watching Batman. on television. And that show was on television at the time. That's something else that I noticed through his movies is that they feature lots of contemporary references. Now, it's harder to do now because movies take 4 years to make and you make a contemporary reference and who knows if that's even got any parlance. But back then, they were cranking them out a lot faster. But still, it's fun to – like the characters of his movies live in the real world. They live in a somewhat recognizable world of everybody else where kids are watching Batman like they were doing in 1967.
Well, that joke goes way back. I mean, in Whodunit, Abbott and Costello win a radio in a contest. They turn it on and they listen to Abbott and Costello doing Who's On First, and they immediately we don't want to hear it. It's a great moment in Steamboat Bill Jr. in the silent era where Buster Keaton is trying on different hats, and he puts on a pork pie hat, looks at himself in the mirror, and immediately, you know, because that was his normal hat. So, referential humor goes back quite a ways, but you know, certainly Frank did it too. But again, that comes out of you know, again, the Warner Brother cartoon tradition where everybody's aware they're in a cartoon, they're talking to the audience, you know, knowing that they're in a cartoon. So it's just, again, it was a traditional humor, but it, you know, he really played it up in one. And again, the Priest was Fox and Batman was Fox. So again, it was just, you know, just, plus it doubles as a plug for the TV show, which is unfortunate with the air. So, you know, it's a win-win situation.
Do you agree with the general assessment, and I mentioned this in the intro, and in that his two Jane Mansfield films are his best work? Do you think that that's generally true?
I would say they're certainly among his top five, yeah. There's no question about it. But one and two, I don't think so. I think, I would make a case maybe for Rock Hunter, possibly number one. My personal feeling is that I think Son of Pale Faces.
Really?
Because that really is, you know, his fully complete vision where, you know, he's basically Bob Hope and bending his vision of what a Bob Hope movie should be. And let's not forget, you've got Roy Rogers essentially playing himself in love a Bob Hope movie. And, you know, that's about as meta or Pirandellian, if you want to use the fancy term, as you can get. Because you don't normally see that sort of. And then you got DeMille popping up, actually filming the scene. You know, and then Mark go up at one point. So it's what works together is whole with the W. And I remember about 20 years ago, we honored Jane Russell at Cinecon. And because there was a rights issue involved, Son of Pale Face was sort of out of circulation at that point. And so I said, if we're going to, hasn't been around. It's a great audience picture. And I knew Linda, so I wrote her a letter asking if she would give the necessary clearance, and she said absolutely. Over Christmas, Sony had just preserved the film because Sony has some rights, not all, and technically nobody has theatrical enough. So we had this beautiful restored print, and the theater was packed with screaming of laughter, as they should. And again, it goes back to the fact that people, unfortunately, tend to think of Bob Hope now in terms of his later years when he had gotten old and now he just wasn't funny anymore. But when you go back to the 40s and early 50s, when he's still in the top of his game, and you think, my God, this guy's... And, you know, but Bob Hope, like most comedians, is good as the material they're given and the directors they have. And in Frantastic, he had a guy who was totally in sync with what made Bob Hope Bob Hope.
I watched the Lemon Drop Kid a bunch of times, I genuinely laughed out loud, which I don't do at most modern comedies, let alone something that's 70 years old. But there was a bunch of times where I genuinely laughed. At one point, my wife was in the other room. She was like, "What are you watching?" And I said, "This is Bob Hope movie, The Lemon Drop Kid." And it was like, it was really, really funny.
Well, also, don't forget, most comedies, they aren't fun.
Yeah, that's true.
And I finally went to see Anyone But You because it was doing so much business. I said, all right, I've got to see what this is all about. And it was like stone face is the whole thing. I think it's the first movie made entirely by AI. They took Much Ado About Nothing and Ticket to Paradise, fed them into a computer, and and then added, make sure all the women are skinny with big knockers and everybody over 40 is an idiot. And it spewed out this picture. And the fact that it did business, you know, sort of says, oh my God, people are crying for comedies. Nobody's making them, you know, overlooking the fact that the biggest picture of last year was Barbie, which was a comedy. So, and I just made a comedy and I'm looking for a description. What do I know? And if you can let me plug for a moment, my picture, which is called Rockin' Doors, Try to Write a Movie, you know, I've been telling people it's a live-action Tex Avery movie, which is exactly true. It's really a new Frank Tashman. It is a very Frank Tashman, but albeit with Tex Avery gets. But is that you mentioned Frank Tashman to anyone who's not a hardcore film buff, you're going to go, who?
Yeah.
Where, I mean, with Tex Avery, there's a chance that there will be a glimmer of recognition. So that's sort of the route I'm following.
I could not find hardly, there's a book about Frank Tashlin that I read called Tashlin-esque, The Hollywood yes. Comedies of Frank Tashlin by Ethan D. Seif, I believe you say his name.
Yes,
and I enjoyed it, but it's not about Tashlin in any real way. It's about his films. And that was, you know, I appreciated that, but I wanted to learn more about the man. And unfortunately, there's just nothing out there. I mean, part of it was that he died young.
But, you know, it's well, first of all, it's the only book about Tashlin written in English. So we're kind of stuck with it. Secondly, you know, a lot of people don't lead particularly interesting lives. Maybe, you know, what materially had a, you know, I think he, if memory serves, he was born, you know, in a fairly middle class household. And it was really interesting, you know, in his life. His life really was, in a very real sense, about work. And maybe there's not that much of it in there because there simply wasn't much to tell.
Maybe. I mean, I said I would love to have heard from him. He seems like a really irreverent guy. I mean, I mentioned that he worked for like six different animation studios in 10 years. You know, he just went from place to place. And, you know, nowadays people go from animation to live action a little more regularly. But right. Back then it was very rare.
You know, we have Tim Burton and we have Brad Bird and I guess William Miller, you know, and I mean, but, you know, there's a hell of a lot more animation now than there was back in the old days. You know, you got an animated feature maybe once every 2 or 3 years. Now you get one a month. And so it's you know, Kung Fu Panda is barely out of theaters. You got Inside Out 2, and now Despicable Me is opening up. And 2 is nowhere nearly done, and they're just piling in on top of each other. Those are just the ones in major studios. So, you know, it's inevitable. I mean, you could also make a case for David Swift, but I was lucky to get to know David in the last couple of years.
One of the things that I found really interesting about, you know, his career trajectory, again, he mentioned he works with Bob Hope in the beginning, and then he does Susan Slept Here with Debbie Reynolds, and then he does Lewis Martin and Lewis with Artists and Models, and then he does their last film together. But then he moves on to working with Lewis exclusively, and he does six movies together with this guy. And, you know, we all know Jerry Lewis was not super easy to get along with.
Patience of a saint.
You know, and right, and you're like, how, you know, and then there's even a quote from Jerry Lewis where he says something like, everything I learned about comedy directing, I learned from Tashlin, which is, that's an extraordinary thing for Jerry. Now, again, you know, I will admit, I watched a bunch of the Jerry Lewis ones and I didn't laugh very much. I just don't find Jerry Lewis funny. I kind of sit there and I go, I appreciate him as for the innovator that he was and for the legend that he was, but I can't say that I laughed at all, like during the Disorderly Orderly or Who's Minding the Store. But it's just amazing to think that Frank Tashlin could do this many films with the guy. And they had, you know, it seems like the only reason they stopped working together is that Lewis was ready to just do his own, direct himself.
Well, he already had them.
Oh, they overlapped?
Jerry literally referred to Tashlin as my teacher. And it's important to remember that, you know, Jerry had expressed interest in directing, and Tashlin said, sure, you know, and he would show him how the camera worked, and he would show him a little bit about editing, and he'd let him shadow him on the set, you know. And so, in a very real sense, Frank Tashlin, inadvertently, was what gave us Jerry Lewis as a filmmaker. And, you know, and of course, Jerry being Jerry, you know, I mean, you know, yes, it's like, yes, I owe everything to Patchlin. On a bad day, because I remember several years ago, Motion Picture Academy had an annual series of lectures by directors. And one year they had Jerry on, but Jerry was there as a, to talk about directing more so than acting. And of course, they ran a bunch of clips. And they were mostly self-contained, you know, routines, which really hammered home the idea that, you know, for Jerry, for the most part, movies were a bunch of hilarious routines strung together on the thinnest of storylines, which is where he often faltered. But what was interesting, never once in that entire evening did he ever mention Patchlin. Result, you know, the key to cinematic integrity is cinematic autonomy, you know, that kind of stuff. And there was an audience Q&A, and I was really, really tempted to walk up to the microphone and just say, Mr. Lewis, would you talk a little bit about Frank Patchlin's influence on you? And I was, but I didn't, because I was afraid he'd start screaming and yelling and demanding that I be thrown out of the theater. So I, maybe I should. But the people who know, know. And if you look at Jerry's movies, the Patchlin influence is absolutely unmistakable. And it's only money. The climax of is the runaway hot lawnmower. That's not a Jerry Lewis gag. That's a Frank Patchlin. Credited to John Fenton Murray, who's an excellent writer. That is absolutely Patchlin all the way. Or, you know, the scene in Who's Minding the Store where he's trying to get the giant television set with the ladders and everything. Again, that's not Jerry, that's Frank. And the problem with Jerry, because, you know, he had that whole Chaplin thing, so yeah, it was all pathos. And it's really tough to reconcile that with that over-the-top zany comedy. So you have these giant lurches and tone batches. And it doesn't hang together well. And if you look at the first Patchlin trilogy, which is Geisha Boy and Rockabye Baby, and especially Cinderfella, Jerry was Patchlin's witnesses. You really see Jerry exerting his control and, you know, drowning the stuff in pathos almost to the point where, especially Cinderfella, parts of it are really tough to sit through. And then when you trilogy, which is it's only money, who's minding the store, and disorderly orderly. I don't know what happened, but Jerry pulls back on that, and Patchlin has much firmer control. And those are the three, I think, those are the three of Jerry's four best pictures. The fourth, of course, being The Nutty Professor, where for once he had a solid storyline and everything out of that space, which was, of course, Dr. Jekyll's side. So, you know, at some point, you could go back and you look at the early 60s, even a picture like The Ladies' Man, where the set is the star, but there's some absolute brilliant on there, and individual scenes in The Errand Boy. But the problem is, you go back and you just want to go back and cut out all scenes, you know, that have no place in the picture. And it's like, wow, you've got a really good movie. I mean, in The Errand Boy, every time he has that scene with that stupid hand puppet, it's like, fast forward, you know. But of course, in a theater, you didn't have that option. You had to sit there and.
I'll admit that I was a little scared to watch The Geisha Boy because in some of his other movies, Jerry has put the buck teeth in and done the whole, you know, miso soli bit. And I was like, is that going to be the whole movie? I don't think I could see that. Now, luckily, he doesn't do any of that. It's actually, as you say, it's Jerry in more of a Chaplin mode because he befriends this little boy and, you know, it's actually a very sweet movie, but I didn't know that going in, and I was a little like, oh boy, okay. But I was saying that one, luckily, that stuff does not happen.
But we cannot have presentism. You know? Say, okay, this is the way things were back, let it go.
Yeah.
It's on that level because we may change, but the films can't. You know, I just say, okay, you know, it was a less enlightened time, but that's the way things were. And, you know, I mean, if you start to erase everything that, you know, even borderline offensive, you know, what happens to Turner Classic Movies?
Yeah.
You can't watch it more than half an hour, you know. I mean, my God, three quarters of Tex Avery cartoons usually end with a bomb going off in somebody's face. And when the smoke clears, they look like Little Eva from Uncle Tom's Cabin, you know, with the black and the red lips and the big You know, come on. You know, just, you know, grow up. You know, just that's the way it was. Just accept it. Okay, we've moved beyond that. We're better than that now.
Something I noticed through a lot of his films is there's a lot of fourth wall breaking.
Yes.
And I sort of, you know, not all of them, obviously, but a lot of them. And like Hollywood or Bust, which, as I mentioned, it's Martin and Lewis's last film together. It literally ends with the two of them walking right into the camera to the point where they black out the screen. And they knew they were packing it in. They had decided to split as a comedy team, and they had to shoot the movie anyway because of contractual obligations. And I have to think that is some slight indication of we're saying goodbye to these two, of them, you know, they're in this movie, and then all of a sudden they look right in the camera and walk right into it. And it's kind of sweet in its own way because it's the last time you're going to see these two together in any sort of way. Even something like his Bing Crosby movie, Say One for Me, which is this, most people consider not really one of his better ones. I didn't love it a whole lot. That movie it opens for 5 solid minutes with no credits, credits. And I watched it it's not available anywhere except on YouTube. So I watched it on YouTube and I'm watching it and I'm going, is this print? Was the opening cut from this print? Because there's no credits. I've never seen a movie in the 1950s not open with titles. Then they don't do that. And then they have a whole musical number and then the credits come in. I'm like, wow, that's really interesting. I have to wonder what people thought about that in 1959.
There had been cold opens before, at least as far back as 1939, of Mice and Men opens that way. And of course, there were movies like Citizen Kane and Anderson where all the credits were. So, you know, it was completely unusual. Around the World in 80 Days, 1956, all the credits were there. So it was unusual, but not, you know, unique in that regard. But anyway, what I was about to say was, as far as the ending of Hollywood at Bust goes, remember that Jerry repeated that gag 7 years later in Nutty Professor when Cass is taking curtain calls and it goes to black and his career was clearly nowhere nearly over. So, but again, that fourth wall break, which again goes back to, you know, well, it goes back to Greek drama, but certainly in the movies in the first decade of the talkies, that was a constant thing. Groucho, Bob Hope, W.C. Fields, you know, all the George Burns, all the cartoon characters like Bugs Bunny. They're always breaking. They're always talking about hey, this is, you know. So, and Ashland came out of this. So naturally, he would turn that over. Actually, a lot of that came from Vaudeville because, you know, a lot of those people started in Vaudeville. We used to addressing the audience. In fact, you know, the Biffle and Schuster shorts I did were built around this fake comedy team. So of course, there was a lot of fourth, a lot of it in my new movie, too, because I loved breaking the fourth wall, because you're basically inviting the audience into the picture and making them, in a very real sense, co-conspirators with the actor, and making them feel like they're part of the experience. That's wonderful.
There's a part in Rock Hunter where I think it's Randall looks at his script and he says, what the movie we're doing is called The Girl Can't Help It. And he goes, oh no, we already did that. And I thought, well, you know, again, like you're saying, he's not the only person ever to do it, but that's still unusual that Tashlin is relying on the audience to maybe know that he directed both those movies. That, you know, that would be pretty inside information.
I'm sure Fox advertised that way, you know, the people who gave you The Girl Can't Help It are back, you know, blah, 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 Jane Mansfield is back. And so, and again, that's an ancient joke in Porky's Duck Hunt, you know, Porky puts through, goes, hey, that wasn't the script. You know, so again, an ancient gag just reused one more time.
yeah, and you mentioned Tom Yule does the bit with the VistaVision screen and all that stuff.
Comes into the cartoon tradition of, for lack of a better term, the plasticity of film. You know, Tex Avery would have gags like, I think it's Northwest, literally runs out of the frame and you see the perforations and the white, he runs back, you know, or Duck Amuck, Chuck Jones, where, you know, the film's stalls on the projector and you see two Daffys, one above the frame line. You know, this, again, This isn't Tashlin reinventing the wheel. This is Tashlin just putting further miles on the wheel.
In the Alphabet Murders, which is, you know, a sort of ostensibly a more serious film because it's a murder mystery. I mean, it's a comedy, but it's a murder mystery that features, first of all, an intro of Tony Randall introducing himself and saying I'm about to be playing Hercule
Albert.
Poirot. And it features a cameo from Margaret Rutherford playing Miss Marple. Which is, I think, I'm not an Agatha Christie expert, but as far as I know, it's the only time those characters ever overlapped.
Well, what happened was, Ruth wore Miss Marple, and in the interim, she'd won an Oscar, and I think she just decided enough, you know. So MGM said, all right, why don't we start with Poirot? And Rutherford agreed to do the cameo, where she's almost literally handing the baton to Randall. To start a new series. The problem was that A, audiences didn't accept Randall as Poirot, and
right.
B, you know, Tashlin tried to make it too much of a comedy and not enough of a murder mystery, and audiences just felt, this isn't really. And so they didn't do any more, which is a chance. It's actually quite a nice film. And, you know, Tashlin famously said that directing Randall was, as he put it, like playing a Stradivarius. He was as good an actor. For that, those, not necessarily Poirot, but in general, as you could get. I mean, that sidekick kind of thing you would do. You know, that's, you know, everybody always talks about the Rock Hudson Doris Day movies, but they were all Rock Hudson Doris Day Tony Randall movies. Randall was in every single one of them as well. And you know, he, you know, years ago, sorry to go keep going back to cinema, Barbara Rush, and she asked to show O Men, O Women. And though, even though Randall was like fourth or fifth film, it really wasn't a very most interesting picture. And the character he's playing is Felix Unger, 13 years before he actually played Felix Unger. You see the roots of that character and all the nervous takes he takes and everything else he does. It's like almost an audition for the character. See, I can't believe it as a Broadway play. So, you know, Randall already had that character nailed down. So, you know, he's one of those guys where you practically didn't need to direct him because he would just show up every day and know what to do. And I think that's one of the reasons that I'm working with him such a pleasure, especially compared to working with Jerry Lewis.
Right. All right. So after he does Alphabet Murders, he does two films with Doris Day. And as I mentioned, The Glass Bottom Boat, big hit. And then he does Caprice, which was not. And why do you think one works and the other doesn't? Because I watched them both and I didn't dislike Caprice, but I didn't laugh either really at all. And I laughed a bunch of times at Glass Bottom Boat, even though it's Doris and sort of a spy plot.
Well, Taylor's out commentary. Glass Bottom Boat is not a Doris Day movie. It's a Frank Tashlin movie that happens to star Doris. And I think it's Tashlin's great undiscovered masterpiece because, again, it's totally his vision and everything puts together. And it's like how to direct visual comedy. And one of the things I always cite is there's a scene early in the picture where they are walking across, you know, the missile base. And Rod Taylor has to disgorge a whole lot of exposition. You know, that sort of thing isn't particularly interesting. So what Tashlin did was he found a hardback for Paul. And he says, hey, you guys are walking and talking. Fiddle with the helmet. Try to get it to stay on your head, you know. And that's the scene. It's Bob Taylor giving this information, but instead of give him 100% attention, you're looking at Doris struggling with the helmet. The scene works beautifully. And of course, he has all these wonderful comedy actors like Paul Lynn, and Dan Martin and Edward Andrews and Dom DeLuise popping it out. In fact, it's funny, if you look at the Dom DeLuise scene, which is kind of self-contained, you know, where he's trying to plant a bug in her apartment.
Yeah.
And the world, like something he had written for Jerry Lewis. And then for whatever reason, either he couldn't figure it into the script or Jerry didn't want to do it. So he probably filed it away and said, okay, I'll do this with Dom DeLuise. Because if you look at the scene in a self-contained, and then imagine Jerry Lewis in that role, you think, oh my God, of course. Absolutely. And, you know, and Doris in the movie, it shows she's game for anything. She's so much more loose and funny than she is in almost all of her other pictures. She's essentially playing a straight woman that you realize you wish she'd done more of this. And a lot of that is Tatchell, even though he's not one of the credited, it's still, you know, still very much his picture. And I like the fact that, you know, she's willing to make fun of herself. There's a scene early picture where she does a goofy version of Hey Sarah Sarah, her signature song. And so she's clearly in on the joke and having a great time. And I know, I remember some years ago, UCLA did a Tatchell retrospective, and they wanted to show the glass bottom boat. They had to borrow a print from the BFI because
Wow.
there was prints in America of a Doris Day movie. I mean, now it's out on DVD, thank God. And I think they have a print in the interview. For a while, that was kind of a tough movie to see, except if it popped up on television, where, of course, it would have been panned and scanned because it's a show. And, of course, you know, Ashland did understand, you know, the importance of framing that. But it's a wildly undervalued picture. Priest, yeah, you want it to work, and it doesn't. And I think the problem is that it just wasn't the right vehicle for Doris Day. I think it needed someone more like Paula Prentice or McLean or someone who fit more comfortably into that spot. I mean, that's just my opinion. It's not one of them. Want it to be better, especially after they work so well together. Oh, but, you know, some days you eat the bear and some days the bear eats you. Fed by the bear.
Something else that I noticed kind of throughout his films, again, not every single one, but a lot of them, and even in Glass Bottom Boat, there's a lot of lasciviousness in them. There's a lot of sex. There's a lot of female skin, more revealing female skin than you would expect for, say, a 1957 movie or something like that, or characters that are fairly open with their carnal desires. I mean, there's a gag in The Lieutenant Wore Skirts, which is one of his less famous ones. I like that one because it has Sherry North in it, and I'm a big fan of Sherry North. But there's a gag where Tom Ewell is in a bedroom. He's in his bedroom, and he doesn't realize that a party guest has come into the bedroom to lay down because he's got a headache or something. And he takes his trousers off, and he doesn't realize this woman's there. And this woman sees this random guy taking his pants off, and she screams, and he shoots it through Tom Ewell's bare legs above the pants, which are now on the floor, through his bare legs, under his underwear, through to the bedroom where the woman is screaming. And I remember thinking, that's, how did he get away with that for like 1956? And there's a lot of that in his movies. And he's always just trying to sneak it in. And I have to think that that's his irreverence popping through, is that he realizes that it's the 50s and people are so uptight about this stuff that he's sneaking it in. And because all of his films, every single one, are comedies, it seems less threatening than it would be if it was in another genre kind of movie.
Well, again, that goes back to the cartoons. I mean, if you remember Plain Daphne, where there's this sort of proto Jessica Rabbit as the villainous, you know, with a body that looks like a martini glass. So, you know, of course, that's why Jane Mansfield was the perfect actress, because she was sort of the live action version of that character.
Yep.
Last Bottom Boat, there's that scene where Poland and I think
Dick Martin,
and then I guess it's Edward Andrews who finds them acting together in bed. And one of them, and I think it's Lynn, says to Dick Martin, "Shall we go pick out furniture tomorrow?" Which is a very gay joke for 1966. And again, he got away with it because everybody knew Paul Lynn. And they figured, okay, well, you know, we'll let it pass. But what's interesting also is at the end of I don't want to spoil it, but a very certain famous comedian has a gag cameo at the very end.
Yep.
Who turns out to be her old, you know, school boyfriend. And she says, "How come you never told me? How come you never tried to kiss me?" And he says, "I could never get that close to you." It turned out, how did that get past the production code? And it turned out it didn't. He added that scene after it had already been approved. So, apparently, nobody noticed.
I love it, Frank. I love Frank Dashlin.
Well, it's not that bad. Yeah. And yeah, but it also in the same picture when they're talking about the corporation, he says that Jay Mansfield is the titular. And again, you sit there and go, holy crap. But again, titular is a valid word. So, you know, if you see a second meaning, it's your dirty mind.
Right. Yeah, and the girl can't help it. She's carrying around milk jugs that she's picked up from the stoop.
He had the ability to walk right up to the line. He was not alone in that regard. You know, some people knew where the limits were. So that, you know, yeah, he did get away with a lot. you correctly observed, you can get away with more of that stuff in a comedy than you can in a drama.
Yeah. So speaking of lasciviousness, we do need to talk about the private navy of Sergeant O'Farrell, which, as I mentioned, it was Tashlin's last film. It stars Bob Hope, as I mentioned. It also stars Phyllis Diller, Gina Lola Brigida, who is stunning in the movie. Like, again, more sexual than I would expect for a Bob Hope comedy. Like, just much more, yeah. You know.
I don't know. He had, you know, Hope was always leering at, you know, after. And, you know, and the older he got, the more beautiful the women came.
Right,
came.
Right.
And right. I don't know if you've ever seen I'll Take Sweet, but oh my God.
I have
God,
not, no.
Place, the film is just filled with gorgeous blondes with huge chests. And you sit there and go, holy crap. You know, I'm sitting there 14 years old going, oh boy, I'm really enjoying this. And then I saw it again years later and went, oh God, this is something. Joan Collins and The Road to Hong Kong and Edie Adams and Ursula Anderson call me Juana, so, you know. And Phyllis Diller was there to sort of, you know, balance the scales.
Well, yeah, I'll mention that in a second. I said it also features Jeffrey Hunter, Dick Sargent, Mako, Henry Wilcox, and because I'm a big MASH fan, I need to mention it features William Christopher, Father Mulcahy, in the movie. Yeah. For anyone who hasn't seen it, which is almost virtually everybody listening to this, the bare bones plot is Bob Hope plays Sergeant O'Farrell, a soldier stationed on an island base during World War II. Everyone there is so bored and listless that he tries to deliver the only two things that his fellow servicemen want, women and beer. When a cargo ship of the latter gets sunk by a Japanese sub, O'Farrell schemes to have the loot retrieved while also arranging for some nurses to visit. Unfortunately, the nurses consist of six men and only one female, Nurse Nellie Krause, played by Phyllis Diller. And, you know, like you were talking about earlier, the Phyllis Diller stuff, you have to look at it in the context of when it was made, because it's all ugly jokes. It's all,
but that was her entire,
you know,
career.
But that was her bit, right? That was her whole thing, was the laugh.
But yeah, I mean, you know, but fine comedy actress, and she and Hope were, I mean, they did a bunch of things together.
Yeah, they did.
Phyllis Diller, anything, you're guaranteed solid laughs. Now, the picture itself, it is sort of a blender film. You've got the shipwrecked whiskey, which comes out of whiskey galore, well, shipwrecked beer. You know, how do we get the beer, you know? And then you got the nurses, which is straight out of Mr. Roberts. And then you've also got Broadside, which was the McHale's Navy spinoff.
Yeah.
Not coincidentally, co-star Dix. But I have a theory about the script of Sergeant O'Farrell. And I have no documented evidence of it. But this is my belief. It was written in 1965 originally. Well, not the script, the story, based on the screen story. And if you look at it with a critical eye and connect all the dots, what in a very real sense seems to be what was intended to be a third McHale's Navy feature film. It's all there. And I think what happened was, because 65 was the year of the second McHale's Navy feature, and then after that ABC canceled the series because Flynn and Borgnine just were ready to kill each other. And so the two guys who wrote the I will just stop this around and, you know, adjust it as needed. And it got its way to Bob Hope, and Hope had the company had a deal in the UA. And he said, fine, let's make this. And then they rewrote it into a Bob Hope movie. But again, the story is all there. As noted, you have Dick Sargent in there. Plus, you've got Mako, who was a recurring on McHale's Navy as a Japanese soldier. So, you know, the links are definitely there. And you sit, and as you watch it, you think, you know, try to think of this as McHale's Navy, and then, yeah, all the pieces kind of fall into place. Again, this is just a theory, concrete evidence, but if you think about it, string the circumstantial evidence together, and it kind of fits. And let me just say for the record, I do not think it's a bomb. I mean, granted, it's not his best picture. And it's not Bob Hope's best picture. But I think it's very watchable. He made a very bad movie. You know, some movies are less good than others, and some are, you know, mediocre. But I don't consider this, you know, bad, a bomb, as Len calls it. You know, it is what it is.
When I watched it, I did feel like I did say to myself, this does feel like a big McHale's Navy episode. It just has
there
that.
You are, with Bob essentially playing Carl Valentine.
Right. I mean, it doesn't have, I don't, it doesn't have any of, from what I, so I watched it twice. I did my, you know, I did my bit for the show. It doesn't seem to have any of the visual gags, kind of. The sort of very well put together visual gags that Tashlin is famous for. And I mean, yeah, it's got fourth wall breaking, but that's Bob Hope. Bob Hope just did that. You know, he was doing that all the time. But you mentioned that, you know, Tashlin didn't write it. So it maybe was that he was just a gun for hire.
No, he is the credited screenwriter.
Well, so, but I mean, not the story, though.
No, he took the story that the two guys had written. I've forgotten their name. Right. He wrote as a Hope vehicle. As for the lack of visual gags, if you look at the picture, it's obviously it was made on not a big budget.
Right.
And also, you got to remember, Hope was 64 years old, and a lot of the other actors weren't that much younger.
Yeah.
And they're those kind of side gags. You know, you look at the features of the Three Stooges made in the late 50s and the mid 60s, you don't see a lot of you know, mostly it's just slapping. Because, you know, they're too old to do anything more expensive than that, you know. And I think that was also the problem with Jerry Lewis, is if you could just play the kid for so long, and then once middle age, it's no longer fun. And eventually becomes a little bit pathetic. You know, and that happens. And, you know, you look at the later Bowery Boys movies, and you think, these guys are in their 50s. What the hell is going on? They're still acting. They're the dead-end kids. It's, you know... When you play, you know, man-child, as Curly Howard did and Lou Costello did, you know, on and on and on, you know, the older you get, the tougher it is to maintain that. And you could argue in a very early and Lou probably did themselves a favor by dying relatively young because they would have been able to sustain themselves playing that particular persona as long as they could, because it would have just become embarrassing. I mean, want people to shift into different kind of roles. Maybe they could have. Maybe they.
Yeah, I mean, I know they were still making Bob Hope, you know, cranked out a movie every year, basically from 50s through like the early 70s.
Yeah.
And he had his audience that was different from what was going on in the world. But I do have to think that in 1968, were audiences that, you know, it's right in the middle of the Vietnam War. Are audiences interested in a wacky army comedy? Yeah, it's set during World War II.
Well,
but it's
they were, you know, good comedy. And there were good war comedies being made then. Kelly's Heroes and What Did You Do in the War? But, you know, Hope, you know, had grown increasingly out of touch with his audience. This happens, you know, people move on, you know. Great tragic examples is Billy Wilder. You know, for years was ahead of the curve, and then eventually he found himself behind the curve. His version of Front Page, another picture, fairly maligned, and another shameless plug to the commentary for.
Enjoyed that very much. That's in my collection.
Thank you. I think, you know, I mean, the picture was successful, but it was, is this the best Billy Wilder can do at this point? You know, and it's... And it's a good film, but, you know, it was, at that point, we expected something with more teeth from Billy Wilder.
Right.
And we didn't get him. I think what happened was, and again, just an opinion, I think what happened to Private Life to Sherlock Holmes broke, never really recovered from that spectacular screw over. You know, his subsequent films are all entertaining and of interest. Even Buddy Buddy, as, you know, as horrible as his reputation is, isn't that bad. But, and he sat around and he said, I have drawers full of scripts. And, you know, you sit there and you think, okay, if you don't want Wilder to direct anymore, you know, get somebody else to direct him. Give him the script. Give it to, you know, Blake Edwards or, you know, whomever. Give him the film. with Wilder's input. But no, nobody was interested because everybody felt that Billy Wilder's moment had come. And I think maybe in a sense that's what happened to Tatchell too, is that that sort of thing, you know, comedy was changing in the late 60s. Maybe if he had hitched himself to someone other than or Doris Day, who was already in her 40s and was right. already being dismissed as old fashioned, you know, the perpetual version, even though she was now in her 40s, you know, I think, you know, he might have sustained his career a little longer if he'd started working with the younger talent.
No, that yeah, well, that leads exactly into what was going to be my exit question for you, which was, I mean, Frank Tashlin died at only 59 years old.
Yeah.
And so he didn't, you know, he had not made a film for 5 years by that point. So maybe the die was cast and that he was never going to work, you know, direct another film at that point. But do you think, was there somebody, do you think from the 70s that emerged as a comedian or an actor that Tashlin could have worked well? I mean, it's kind of hard to, you know, sort of it's we'll sure, never I mean, know. But I mean,
Dick Van Dyke, certainly. Mm. I think Gene Wilder, certainly.
Mm.
Oh, and, you know, Rock Hudson and Tony Randall were still around, you know, still, you know, they hadn't yet had their, you know, they hadn't yet hit the wall. Steve Martin a few years later.
Mm.
You know, and even that first generation of Saturday Night Live people, like especially Belushi and Gilda Radner, I think they would have fit into the world. I think even a relatively straight actor like James Garner would have gone into that. So maybe even Peter Sellers, if he was willing to put up with it. So, no, yeah, I think had he, you know, made himself available to a newer generation of comedy actors, I think he might have been it. But again, we have to remember he was very, very heavy. I think at one point he was close to 300 pounds. And I think that affected his health.
And I didn't know that. Okay.
Thrombosis, you know. Just, you know, that doesn't happen often to skinny people. And so, no, I think, you know, I think his career, you know, ended prematurely. I think there was, you know, there certainly was an abundance of talent that he could have continued to work with. That I mean, I know it's crazy. Even Zero Mostel.
Mm.
I mean, there was a guy, you know, who was up for anything. I mean, it was a pain in the ass. But, yeah, I mean, I could certainly see, you know, and I go back and look at, not that I'm knocking Richard Lester, but you look at the film version of Funny Thing Out of the Way, the Forum. And, you know, Lester tried too hard to, you know, break it out of his stage origins and turn it into this wild slapstick comedy world, chase this and everything. And he really didn't do right by the musical. And I think if Tashlin had done it instead of Lester, I think it might have worked better because he wasn't trying to reinvent the wheel. He would have said, the show works, let's not futz with it too much.
Those are all a bunch of interesting suggestions. Steve Martin, I really think that's an interesting
absolutely.
Idea. You know,
and, you know, he ended up working with Carl Reiner.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, for those of you that again are listening to this and you're not familiar with Frank Tashlin's work, I mean, most of you probably listening are familiar with the cartoons, certainly. But if you're not familiar with the films, a lot of them are admittedly kind of hard to find. I had to really search around the internet to find and on YouTube to find some of these movies, but they are available. The more famous ones are available on DVD or Blu-ray, or you can stream them. And I would absolutely recommend The Girl Can't Help It and Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter to anyone. I think they're really, really funny and still hold up, even though they're skewering things from the 1950s, but they're both really, really funny movies.
And let me just interject quickly that if you watch Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, everything that Mad Men was making fun of is right there in that movie.
Yep.
Yeah. Right down the fact that he's an advertising executive.
Yeah, it's just an absolutely terrific, terrific movie. So, so like I said, it absolutely worth finding these films. And I was so glad that I got to spend a whole month watching all these movies because they were really, really a lot. Even the lesser ones were still very entertaining and delightful in their own way. So, Michael, I really appreciate
Let me
you
again,
doing
to add to your list. I really urge people to seek out Pale Face and Glass Bottom both. And of the Lewis pictures, I really, really like It's Only Money. I think
Okay.
that certainly needs to be reevaluated. So there's three more. That would be my top five passions.
Okay. That's a great list. So again, Michael, I really appreciate you doing this. As I mentioned, I think I said this before we started recording. I share your estimation regarding It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And I can't say I'm jealous that you got to do the audio commentary with Mark Evanier for Criterion.
They were showing it at TCM Festival, at the Dome, of course, and I ran into my friend from Criterion, Karen Stedler. As we mentioned, we're going to do Mad Mad World, and I
Wow.
literally grabbed her by lapels. And I said, "Mark and I have to do the commentary." Anymore, I said, "You kidding? We have to do a commentary." And she says, "Do you guys have enough material for 2.5 hours?" They said, "Are you kidding? We'll just be getting warmed up." And then Paul both joined us, and so the whole roadshow version, or what was as much as they could, we talked for like over 3 hours, and stuff out. Because that picture is so rich. There's so much going on there, and it's an absolute shanda that it isn't on the National Film Registry. Every year, I send a list of bullet points. Why this movie should be on the list. It doesn't.
I submitted it to them as well when they were doing the open call. I sent
So
that. That was the number one movie
now
I
it's
put.
by Hollywood. I mean, it's like, I don't even want to get started on
Right. That's a
that.
whole other show.
So.
Like I said, I can't be jealous of you because there was no universe that I would ever be asked to do that. But nevertheless, I'm like, oh man, what a gig to
I
be
went.
able to talk about It's a Mad, 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 Mad World for 3.5 hours.
I was very lucky that I've been able to do commentaries on a lot of pictures I really like. Also because I work cheap.
No. Well, I do too, and so I'll have to keep that in mind because I've done commentaries, not nearly as many as you, but now I need to know if I run into someone from, say, Criterion or Kino, I could just like shake them and kind of guilt them into it. It's a good, I don't think to do that, but I might try
Men shaking franchise. He's a pretty big fella.
that. So again, I really appreciate you doing this. It's just
Thank you
real,
for
it's a
the
real
pleasure.
honor to have you on the show.
Contributed in some menial fashion.
Absolutely. So one last thing that I want to mention to everybody. We're starting a new segment here on the show, which I'm sort of, loosely calling Admit One, which is going to be brief little stories about seeing movies in the theater. And that is inspired by the fact that recently, a lot of you know, I moved from New Jersey to Florida, and my wife and I have been making a point to visit every independent slash repertoire theater that is in the area. We are dead center in the state, and so we are equidistant from Orlando and Tampa and Gainesville, and there are repertoire theaters everywhere. And so we are more than in New Jersey. Actually, there are none in New Jersey, at least where we were. With theater business being a hard business to be in, as you mentioned earlier, other than animated films, no movies are making any money. We're making it a point to spend the money to go see
Good.
films, even if we've owned them already or own them on social media. And so I thought with every episode, I'm just going to highlight one of the visits that we made. Again, it'll be very, very brief, but I just want to give a shout out to these theaters that are doing this thing. So just recently, a couple days ago, actually, my wife and I went to Tampa to a theater called Screen Door. And it is a micro cinema. And they are not kidding when they call it a micro cinema. It is 30 seats. And it's a big screen, but it's just 30 seats. And it's part of kind of like an art complex. And it's just sort of walled off in its own little room. Very, very bare bones. But they were showing an Agnes Varda film, 1995's 101 Nights. And my wife had never seen an Agnes Varda film. I'd only seen one to this point. And we thought, well, here's a great opportunity to see an Agnes Varda film in the big screen. And we did. And we had a great time. We thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. And we will be going back to this theater soon. And you can find them. They're called Screen Door. You just put Screen Door Tampa, Florida, and you'll find their website. And they show an eclectic mix of stuff. And they'll show Swamp Thing one night and Fassbinder the next night. And I think it's because they only have to fill 30 seats that they can sort of get away with doing that. And so we just had an absolutely great time, and we plan to go back as soon as we can. So I just wanted to highlight that. So, Michael, you've obviously you've seen a million movies in that regard, but you've been on the other side of this where you've actually put on screenings
in the repertory world as an exhibitor and as a distributor. So, you know,
amazing. So do you have like an example of something you've shown to somebody that you're particularly proud of?
That I've shown to someone?
That you've exhibited, that you've done, that you've gotten in front of people. I mean,
my exhibition stuff was mostly back in Cincinnati,
mm-hmm.
40 years ago. I mean, most of it is working for MGM Classics, then Paramount and Sony. But I mean, I am proud of the fact that, you know, I don't restore films. I've never restored a film, but I've instigated. And stuff that's out there now that was, you know, butchered and that we have put back. Or things that were even in movie jail, particularly White Dog. And of course, I got It's All True completed. So, and of course, you know, I went to a screening of The Lost Skeleton of Cadaver and fell in love with it. And that in turn led me to co-producing three more of Larry's movies. So, you know, I mean, I've made, you know, Booster Shorts available from Dino Lorber, which people love. And hopefully I'll find distributors for the new picture, and hopefully people will love that. And, you know, one of my dearest friends is Joe Dante. And, like me, he is very much enamored of Cashel. And you can, and in fact, you know, I every time I see one of Joe's movies, I think to myself, this is exactly the way I would have done it. I wouldn't change a thing. And Joe, came to the first cast and crew and friends, got rough cut screening of Rock and Doris, and he loved it. He said it was, oh, he doesn't mind my quoting him. He said, it's the most personal film I've ever seen. You took your whole felt personality and put it up on the screen. And that I did an amazing job with two sets of no money. So that was incredibly kind, but you know, it plays into our mutual sweet spot. I call it zombie vaudeville. Because it's basically we're taking this dead form of comedy and bringing it back from the to hopefully thrill and delight a new generation.
We do have to get going, but I have to thank you for your work on It's All True, because I am a huge Wells fan, and I remember when that came out on home video and that it got restored. So I have, you know, life, time is a flat circle. It's amazing. Getting to talk to you when you were involved in that, because I remember I could not be more excited that film finally got a proper shown to people in a proper release.
My friend Joe McBride, who of course knew Wells very well, said, I'm one of the very few people who ever greenlit an Orson Welles movie. It's true, but you know, I'll take whatever credit I can get on that. That is the single most proud thing I've ever done. Was, you know, this thing that had been lying dormant for, you know, 50 years. Getting it out there, and it cost me my job, but I didn't care because the film will always be there.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. So anyway, again, thank you once again, Michael. I really
You're
appreciate
very
it. Thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of our show on fireandwaterpodcast.com. We're on Twitter at FadeOutPod. If you want to support the network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. So big thanks to Monique D and Donald McWaters for their support of Fade Out. So that's going to do it for this month. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another episode next month. But we've reached the end of this particular script, so for now, it's time to fade out.
Ladies and gentlemen, this break in our motion picture is made out of respect for the TV fans in our audience who are accustomed to constant interruptions in their programs for messages from sponsors. We want all you TV fans to feel at home and not forget the thrill you get watching television on your big 21-inch screens. I have a 21-inch screen myself, and it's loads of fun. TV is a remarkable invention.